Okay. So I downloaded. Do you want to email the question? Or you have questions too? Okay. So basically,
what, you know what I do? I just wing it.
Freestyle session. Okay. So yeah. I still have notes from our conversation that we did over Zoom.
Sure.
So that's so basically we're going to revisit that conversation. So some of these questions may feel familiar, but that's part of the game because I didn't want to hit y'all with any surprises. You get final review.
So, thank you.
Okay. So just letting you know.
All right. And okay. So I'm going to get you to turn down my volume just a little bit.
Okay.
And this one.
What are you, yellow?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now speak again.
How's that?
Oh, yeah.
How's that? Is that better?
Much better.
Okay.
Thank
all
you.
Right. I know I'm a loud talker. That's
Oh, no, that's the thing.
Okay. Everybody else, Ed, can you hear? You good, fine?
Yeah.
Fine?
Okay.
All right. Good.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Yeah. All right. Okay, so we are recording.
The audacity of this pitch. The audacity of this pitch has been brought to you by Diversify IT.
So today we have Ed and Lois, Ed Gomes, and Lois, delightful, talk to me, Lois.
It's Deloach, and I have been threatening now for 20 years we've been married to do the hyphenated Deloach Gomes, but the challenge is people mispronounce Deloach, and they mispronounce Gomes.
They won't anymore. It's done now. This is official. We're going to make this
Try being Derrickson, or also known as Dickerson, or Diedrickson.
Right. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I get everything.
Oh, my God.
Even professional colleagues, it's like, let me introduce you to Chris Dickerson. It's like,
right.
I'm just another Johnson.
It's really interesting when you hear the, artificial intelligence try to pronounce it. Deloach.
Oh, wow. That's
Edward Gomes.
Yeah, Gomes. Yeah, that's right.
I like my DJ on Spotify and how he pronounces some of the artists I listen to.
Yeah.
But it's good that we actually did talk about last names because today, Lois, we are talking a bit about your griot status and your connection to your family, your culture, your heritage through music. Talk to me a little bit about your relationship, with music and storytelling specifically.
So can I interrupt?
No, go ahead.
Can I be the dumb person on the, that's usually my role.
curious.
The curious person. So I don't know if all of our listeners, because I'm one, would know what a griot is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me understand? I mean, I looked it up. I know what it is now, but so I think as we had the conversation, I was like, I don't know that word.
That's why you're in the building, Chris, because right. Everybody doesn't know. You are correct. Go ahead.
Right. So griot, G-R-I-O-T, is of African origin, particularly West African, and it's usually the village-wise person who's the storyteller, in oral traditions and particularly among lots of cultures and African-American cultures and African cultures. So much of what we know about ourselves and our ancestors was passed down, orally from the elders. Right. And so a griot is just a person who takes some responsibility for trying to tell the story.
Great. I should have just asked you when we talked instead of looking it up.
No, it made a great moment right now because the thing is, we're supposed to be helping other people understand what makes up our identities and, informing people about, things that we may not be aware of and culturally. So that was a beautiful cultural exchange.
Thank you. Now I can answer Brandon's question.
So as far as your griot status, do you claim griot status? I feel like you should claim griot status.
I embrace it now. I do regret, and I'm smiling at Ed, because before Baba Chuck Davis passed away a few years ago, he wanted to induct me into the Council of Elders. And, of course, at that time, the thought of being an elder was not necessarily something I thought I deserved, number one, and didn't envision myself that way. And so now, being one among the oldest in my family, you know, since my dad's passing recently, I'm embracing that griot status, because it is partly my responsibility and my siblings' responsibility to hand down these stories to the broader community, but to our children and grandchildren and others, because in the absence of someone who was there or who really received the knowledge, the, as we call it, the primary, you know, information, it'll get lost or distorted. So I do embrace that griot status now.
One of the compelling things that I found in regard to, you know, how you tell stories through song was not only how you tell, you know, other stories, but also, you know, how the stories that you tell, the stories that you connect with, you know, as far as music is concerned, you know, bring you together, you know, as a couple. You talked a little bit about, you know, some of the music that you all connected over, some of the stories that you all connect over. You know, could you tell me a bit about that connection? Give me a little bit of history of, you know, Ed and Lois and how music brought them together.
Well, I'll go first. And I think for me, overall in my life, back to your first question, I can pretty much envision, see, and hear nearly every phase and time of my life. It's almost like a soundtrack to almost everything important that's happened over the course of my life, whether it's childhood, teenage years, young adulthood. You know, in fact, on the way over here today, I was listening to Sounds of Blackness, Head to the Sky. I had a major surgery, not life-threatening, about 20 years ago. And throughout that, I had the headphones on listening to Head to the Sky. You know, that got me through that surgery. So you know, music's really important. And I think when Ed and I first started seeing each other, again, as just friends and acquaintances and colleagues in nonprofit work, every now and then we'd get together and meet up at, what was the music store at?
Like CD Superstore in Brightleaf.
Yeah, CD Superstore in Brightleaf, and then there was another one. And so the big deal back then, you know, you put on the headphones and you listen to the music. And we both shared a common love of music. I think that was among the first conversations we had, was like, what kind of music do you like? And just really thrilled that we both liked the same music.
Yeah, most of the time.
most of the time.
Yeah, and going into a place like that, it was interesting because you know, it was back in the day when they had 5-disc changers, and they preload some things, and so you get to listen what's in the rotation, and it's not necessarily the same thing in the disc that you're standing in front of. And so we'd swap headphones, and we'd go to the other machine just to see what they were listening to and what she liked and versus what I liked. And so, but we did realize that we liked similar styles of music, and the fact that we liked different styles of music as well. Not just R&B, not just jazz, which is basically what we primarily listen to now, but we liked all types of music.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we also learned I'd be listening to something that she was listening to that she really, really liked. Oh, you'll like this. And I'd put it on the headphones and I'd go, let me switch to disc. It's not working for me.
But we talked a lot, too, though, about just our music experience, like some of the concerts we'd been to, you know, before, and sort of, you know, music that bands that we went to see, you know, as teenagers. And so we really we understood each other's history in some ways through the experiences we had connected to music.
And you understood each other so well that you all started stealing CDs from one another. y'all want to tell me a little bit about that? How that went down?
Yeah, it's borrowing without returning. Is that what you call stealing? Yeah, I think that's about right. And so, we did that for quite a while because we recognized that we had similar tastes. And I was like, oh, I've got that CD. You want to borrow it for a while? Sure. And then, you know, I would do the same thing with her. But then when we got married, then we had all these duplicate CDs because we got tired of waiting for the person to return the CD. So we just went out and purchased another copy because we get, you know, it was we were never going to get it back.
That's true. And I think that's, I think he joked about it more than once. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we got married. That way I got my CDs back.
That's right.
Basically, music seems like it's a through line, you know, for both of you. I mean, you all had pretty eclectic tastes, like independent of one another, and then, you know, you all united, you know, in this musical union. Tell me a bit about, you know, how your, going back to you, Lois, in regard to, like, you know, your formulation as an artist was influenced by the music that you listened to growing up, and, you know, how you came into your griotism, if you will. It's a word now. It's happening. Yeah. Griotism is a word.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Couple of things there. One, I now fully appreciate the experience I had living in a rural area, being exposed to lots of different kinds of music, because this was way back in the day when we would listen to AM radio. You put it on one station and you listen to everything they played. So I grew up listening to country music, you know, Hank Williams, you know, Johnny Cash.
I'm not able to see your face in every place that I go.
You know, we listened to the Bee Gees or, you know, whatever was on the radio, you listened to it. Certainly there was some soul, popular stuff. There were a few things that were sort of jazz tinged, but not a lot of, you know, real jazz. Some blues tinged thing. But so whatever was on, you listened to it. Sometimes in the foreground, sometimes in the background. Then not, you know, and then I remember, you know, being just a young kid, because I'm the seventh of 10 children. I had older siblings who had left home by then. And we would actually order records. My brother Donald, rest his soul, would order records from Ernie Record Mart in, I think it was either Nashville or Memphis, and, you know, the 45s. And so if we heard Johnny Taylor, you know, soul song on the radio, or Aretha Franklin, ordered and it showed up. And when they, again, the older siblings left home, they would, you know, the gift was always some music, an album or something like that. But let me just back up a little bit and say, because my family had a band, it was a rock soul band. My older brother, Junior, played lead guitar. My brother, Clint, played bass. Family friends played other instruments. My sister, Sandra, was the singer. And they actually got gigs playing this band, everything from Gladys Knight and the Pips to, again, my brother, Walter, was a big rock fan. So they did a few Ohio Players, some Jimi Hendrix stuff, some Santana stuff. So music, live music, was a big part of, particularly in my, during teenage years, bands were a big deal, and we would go out and listen to bands, and my family had a band. Also, early memories of, in our home now, Ed and I, in our home, I have a Victrola, a Victrola that you played 78s on, that was a gift to me, or left to me, from the neighbor who lived across the field, you know, from a very rural area. And I can remember being a little girl, and she put on those blues records and put that needle down that was the size of a crochet needle. And, you know, we dance and sing, and it was, you know. So there was always some kind of music, you know, around, and lots of different kinds of music around. So for me, as long as it was fairly high quality, you know, you gave it a shot and listened to it. Fast forward, as a teenager and, you know, young adult, when I started buying my own records, it was all, you know, it was all across the board in terms of what I bought. Mostly soul things, but some things that were rock and blues and all kinds of music. Hmm.
So as far as deciding to, you know, go into it yourself, you had some influences, you know, inside the family. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to add your voice to the narrative?
Well, and this is fairly cliche, but it's true. So being raised in a rural area, a lot of our social life revolved around the church. And so it was a given. You were going to be active and serve. you were either going to be on the ushers or you're going to be in the choir. And I was started singing maybe 7, 8, you know, in the choir. And fairly early on, people said that I had a good voice. And so, you know, you've been in these settings probably, you know, a child sang. So, you know, they put you up and sing. And then later when I started playing a little bit of piano, sometimes I was a musician and sometimes we just sing a cappella. So I would say that the influence of that experience in faith communities and in the church was very instrumental in giving me the confidence to step out to sing. And I was in a choir in high school, but raised in a very rural, poor area, well, under-resourced area. We had no music lessons. So when people say, how can you learn songs so fast? Because music for us was singing. That's what we did. We learned songs and we would sing. We didn't have the opportunity to, you know, learn to play trumpet or anything else in school. And so the choir would sing maybe twice a year. And yeah, I was part of that choir. A high school teacher, and this is why I do not underestimate the impact that one person can make on your life. I had a high school teacher who was a physics teacher, but he also directed the band. And he came to me one day and said, there's a singing competition. I think it was the Q's, looking back on it, that was sponsoring this competition in Ahoskie, North Carolina. And he said, I think you should enter. And I'm like, I don't, you know. I trusted him, and he worked with me, and I learned, I think it was a version of the Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. And my dad took off work, which was a big deal. My dad was a brick mason and a carpenter. And if he didn't work, he didn't get paid. But my dad took off work to take me to this afternoon event. And I think I placed maybe second or third. And it was a big deal because I had no aspirations that, you know, that would happen. So, and all that to say that kind of experience gave me the confidence. Then when I went off to UNC Chapel Hill, I joined the BSM Gospel Choir and was soon tapped to be one of the lead singers. So I would often close the show there. So yeah, just a wide range of experiences that gave me the confidence to step out and say, okay. Obviously, some people, you know, they're not running and screaming away, but so I'll try this.
You definitely pulled this guy in. Tell me, what was like the first time you heard her sing?
Oh, it was great. I mean, I think the first time I actually went to see you sing, you were performing at a place that doesn't even exist now.
Weeping Radish.
Yeah, the Weeping Radish. And so that's in a building that doesn't even, it's not even.
That burned.
Yeah.
In the fire.
It's the place that had the explosion.
Downtown. Wow.
Okay. So it was located there.
Okay.
And so I went. You know, we had become friends, and she's talking about, well, you know, if you're interested in coming to see this concert. And so I went to see the concert, and I'm just like totally blown away because, you know, not that I didn't envision that she could sing, but just hearing it. And she's got a very deep, rich voice with lots of range. And, you know, and other people who have seen her sing, they always say the same thing. It's like, how does that voice come out of you? Because they just look at her and they're just like, that's not what I envisioned your voice would be like. But it was very powerful to see her sing. And it was, I could tell that she's a great vocalist. And she's also very good about picking good people to play with her. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and she wants the band to be tight. And so it wasn't like some amateur that just decided to show up and perform. I mean, they were good. Mm-hmm. And so I was just, you know, duly impressed. I mean, it was just amazing to see her. So, you know, we weren't like that in terms of a relationship. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely hooked on her as a performer. So.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, one thing that did stick out in regard to our conversation, that comes from, you know, your observation. You say that you were, you know, enamored, you were entertained. But Lois, you said that I am not an entertainer.
No, that is the one thing that I will request. I don't need much on a rider. You know, when you do a contract, I don't need much. But listed as a mini concert, listed as a musical presentation, but do not list me as entertainment. Because, and part of it is, it's not being arrogant. Mm-hmm. I try to be fairly deliberate about the songs I write, the music I interpret, and it really is a cultural conveyance. Mm-hmm. You know, I want people to enjoy it. If you want to dance and enjoy it, but, you know, I'm not here for your entertainment. And I'll be honest with you, particularly in the context of this, you know, the purpose for which you all are doing this, for far too long, particularly, you know, African-American music, you know, I'm not your singing, dancing, mm-hmm. entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, I take it just much more seriously than that. Mm-hmm. But you can interpret it however you like, but I don't want to consciously, you know, I'm not the one that, you know, oh, you know, I think I mentioned to you in conversation, you know, my last thought is what I'm going to wear, mm-hmm. you know, and all the makeup and the hair. And I'm not knocking that because we are visual and, you know, visual creatures. But it's not about that kind of entertainment for me.
Mm. Yes, I'm Chris.
No, I mean, I'm just sitting here being jealous. I think one of the things that just struck me is that idea of the sort of that image of the mindless entertainer. I mean, up there dancing and entertaining. One moment you talked about someone who stood out for you, and I was in graduate school. I grew up really narrowly. Like, I honestly met the first person I knew was gay in graduate school, and just. I was sort of grew up in a very sheltered way. Went into a class, it was a history of slavery. Sat down at a seminar table. You know, older people, it could be graduate students. A woman sat next to me, said hi to her, sat down. We're all looking around. It's like class about to start. And I'm looking this way, and all of a sudden, the woman to the left or right of me, like, just starts singing. It was like this booming voice, just so powerful, and it was Bernice Johnson Regan, who taught
the
class.
Sweet
Honey in the Rock. Yeah, Sweet Honey in the Rock. That still just, I can feel that power, and she was truly one of the most powerful women I've ever known. I learned a lot from her. I studied under her, and it just, that's, those are my stories. It's more observing versus being able to participate and mm-hmm. being outside of that culture. It makes me jealous. I mean, there's, you know, it's so.
But she made you part of it, though.
Yeah. Bernice, yeah.
Made you, and that's one thing I find fascinating about how you tell stories is, you know, including the audience, you know, by coming at it from this, you know, like I said, storyteller perspective. So
yeah, I was going to say too, and I appreciate that comment because I think of singing as on that continuum of the vocal tradition. Mm-hmm. And when you talk, when Bernice Johnson Regan, whether she's singing or speaking, right, there is a certain amount of attention and depth that it has.
Absolutely.
So, you know, particularly when I start doing this professionally, you know, there were times when it may be just interpreting a song. I was telling somebody one of the first presentations that I did, I just did a vocal rendition of, you know, Langston Hughes' Mother to Son, mm-hmm. you know, as part of that. So.
And Sweet Honey in the Rock started expanding my musical taste. I grew up Catholic, mm-hmm. only singing. That happens in those churches is very, not exactly moving.
Yeah.
So I didn't grow up in the same sort of religious tradition. So I'm really diving into her music. And mm-hmm. so she had mm-hmm. a huge influence on me. And
yeah.
remind me, I got to reach out to her.
And yeah. and with her, a lot of even the protest songs.
Yes.
And is again, on that continuum, we are often put things, want to label them, but they really do cross genres
right.
and, yeah.
Yeah, and again, my background, I grew up Catholic, and so the yeah. whole concept of the, you know, the black church and the music and all those other things, it's a very different thing to walk into the church and to see that and to feel that. And you could tell that she's got that background. That's where she grew up and that's where things started. And so it was a, when I talk about the sort of the booming voice and how it's designed to make you feel, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a different feeling when you hear it coming from someone who grew up that way. And so I still, it still amazes me sometimes just to hear it. You know, and then on the occasions when I get to go to a black church for some, usually it's a bad situation, but when we go to a black church and we hear that vocal and all of that, there's definitely something to it that's completely different than what I grew up with. And so I certainly do appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So as far as your narrative, you know, storytellings and utilizing that booming voice, using, you know, yourself as an instrument to perpetuate, you know, in narratives within your community, how do you choose the stories? You know, how do you choose what you want to write about and what you want to sing about?
I think often there is a personal connection or a personal appreciation. Whether it's singing a song of sorrow and mourning. And in fact, one of the frightening things for me, shouldn't use the word frightening. I remember being 11 or 12 and singing at a funeral because I was in a choir. And an older woman, looking back on it now, she was probably my age then, but, you know, she was old to me at that time because I was maybe 11 years old, 11 or 12. Came up to me and she hugged me with tears in her eyes and she said, "When I die, I want you to sing at my funeral." Now, I'm 11. And of course, I understood death. But I know I didn't do anything wrong, but it was that power of, not from me, but of her saying to me, "When I die, I want you to sing at my funeral." That made such an impression on me. It's like, okay, so your voice does have some impact on people, so you need to be careful how you use it and not to abuse it. And I don't mean to at all indicate that everything is so serious and, you know, all that well thought out. But particularly when I'm doing concerts, I love doing, whether it's jazz standards, but I often try to infuse some of my original music in there because I think I mentioned to you guys previously, my goal, my creative goal as an artist really is the writing part. I feel very blessed and fortunate that I can sing and I have a voice. And but the writing has always been what's interested me most. So I would say just it depends on the occasion. For example, I'm singing in a couple of weeks. It's a benefit in Chapel Hill for a housing advocacy group, and it's to honor someone, Miss Lillian Lee. So I will think about, you know, who she is, what she likes, and what the occasion might call for, and then that will dictate what I sing for that occasion. But the concert that I did last July of all original music, the whole point of it was to present some of those stories and some of that music. So it really does depend on the occasion in terms of what I select to sing or not sing. And then any musician will tell you, then in the moment, if it doesn't feel right, then you pull it off that set list and go, "This doesn't feel right." Or for me, as Ed mentioned, I have the great fortune of working with some very talented musicians. There have been nights where I don't sing very much at all because if I don't feel like I am another instrument on that bandstand, if I don't have anything really to add to this music, then I don't need to just be seen. So it just, it varies.
I mean, as you've evolved as an artist in your musical identity, do you find that there have been like, you know, seasons of your, I guess like your focus, your interests, like what you choose to write about? Do you, I mean, obviously, like, whenever I was in high school, I wrote really dark, brooding poetry, you know, about, you know, the universe and my place in it. And then and now, you know, in my older age, I'm much more reflective. And so I imagine it's the same for you as an artist. You know, what did you first start off, you know, writing about, and how is the Lois today? You know, different.
Well, first of all, Brandon, you have to read some of this brooding poetry.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
I'm going to shave my head and put on all black. It's a whole thing.
I can envision it now. Darkness falls in the universe and the world. Interestingly enough for me, I'm one of those people, and I can admit it now. As the old folks would say, I've always been, you know, older than my age. And some of the things that I'm developing now were ideas that were sparks 20 years ago. And I will revisit some things from time to time. In fact, one of the first recording sessions Ed came with me to, I think were you there for Sunrise? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back and revisit some of those songs because I want to reinterpret them. And even musicians that I really admire and love a lot, folks like Branford Marsalis and others, would tell you, like any artist, whether you're a visual artist, painter, photographer, you know, you're always building on that work, you know, in your head. So I think about this particular tune that I wrote Southern Summer Rain.
I want to be there again. How I long to be there again. Southern summer rain falling down on you, warm and gentle rain.
It's a little bit of a story, you know.
Steering up sweet memory.
But now there's some things I want to add to that. But my idea of what the art can be has developed and changed over time. And I'd like to think in some ways for me, that's part of the season I'm in right now, mm-hmm. that I really do want to dig in and take it to places I haven't been able to before.
Mm. Ed, being in such close proximity to Miss Lois here, mm-hmm. how have you seen her grow and evolve as an artist?
Wow. It's interesting. I think, she says, she wants to be known as more of a writer mm-hmm. and than the performer. And I think I've seen the evolution in the songs that she's writing. And, you know, she's a performer. She's not an entertainer. But I'm actually impressed with the fact that now she's really sort of focusing on, I really want to tell the stories that I've wanted to tell, and I really want to interpret music that I've written that tell a story. A lot of the concerts that I've been to that she has done, it's been a few originals, mm-hmm. lots of standards mm-hmm. Earlier on because you want the audience to feel comfortable with the music and to enjoy what's being presented to them on the stage. And I think she's gotten to the point where she's like, and she's also recognized, people enjoy hearing her sing regardless of what she's singing. And so it doesn't make a difference whether it's something that somebody else wrote versus the things that she's written. I think she's developed more confidence in being able to present the things that really matter to her. She can tell that story, not just interpret what somebody else has written. So that it has her sort of the way that she wants to tell the story that somebody else wrote. And so to me, that's where I've seen her growth as a performer.
You know, and thank you for this question, Brandon, because it also brings to mind for me my greatest joy with music, and I dare say as an artist, is the collaboration and partnership with other musicians. Mm-hmm. Keith, who came into the studio and with me, I don't get to work with him a lot, but I admire him so much because he has this depth, and his wife is a singer, Grammy-nominated singer, and so he really gets vocalists in a way that some other musicians don't because he lives with one and works with one all the time. The other joy is, in the context of this conversation especially, is that I can be on a bandstand any given night, and I have been, mm-hmm. with my son's friends who are now these world-class musicians. Mm-hmm. So the generational difference and the racial difference and the gender difference does not matter. We are a well-oiled machine in the sense that I'm listening, and that's a lot of what music is about, particularly jazz and blues and even gospel music, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, you got to be listening and paying attention at the end of that gospel song if I'm going to spin it around and keep going. And the same thing with jazz. So that's been the greatest joy for me. One of my closest musician friends and companions, Gabe Evans, is down now in Louisville. Has his PhD in music, but he's from Chapel Hill. When Gabe and I first met, maybe he was 19 or 20, maybe a little bit more. He worked quite a bit with John Brown, who heads, mm-hmm. and John and I have worked together a lot too. But Gabe was, not only did we become musical companions, but Gabe was the person who said to me, Lois, I really think you'd enjoy doing the silent meditation retreat, which he had gone to, right? So we developed this partnership and friendship. And I think the music has been a catalyst for so many other really beautiful things in my life. And I think that in itself has helped me evolve as a human being, but also as a more trusting artist. And more than anything else, you just sometimes have to get out of your own way. And when you're with people you trust, whether they're 25 years old because I trust them to know their instrument, or whether they're 75 years old, the opposite's true. A lot of my musician friends have now, have now transitioned. Mm. You know, they're on the other side. And these are world-class, beautiful people that I wouldn't trade it for the world, the experience that I had to just know them as human beings.
The audacity of this pitch. The conversation does not have to stop here. Join us on diversifyit.duke.edu and join our listserv.